Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
On what should have been a typical Wednesday last July, Dr. Kent Brantley woke up feeling ever so slightly off. A rumbly belly, a hint of fever. Assuming he'd be better by midday, he decided to take the morning off. Instead, as his fever persisted, he had to face the reality that he was experiencing the first almost imperceptibly mild symptoms of a disease that had killed just about every patient he'd treated for it, Ebola. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Brantley contracted Ebola, serving as with the medical missionary arm of Samaritan's Purse in Liberia. We all know now he survived the illness. We know his wife, Amber, and their young children had left the country for a family wedding just 3 days before he got sick, meaning they were safe from exposure. But we haven't known much about the time between his first symptoms in Monrovia and his release from Emory Hospital in Atlanta with a clean bill of health. All those long and terrifying weeks when Dr. Brantley experienced the same illness that had spared so few patients in his hospital, when he and Amber could speak on the phone but not touch or even be in the same room, when both had to wrestle with the possibility that he might die. Those details have been kept private until now. But in the interest of keeping the world's attention on the need for compassionate medical care in the developing world, Dr. Kent and Nurse Amber Brantley have decided to share their story. Their new joint memoir is titled Called for Life, How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us into the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks,
it's
Chris.
Great to be here.
You went to Liberia before the Ebola epidemic had taken hold there. What drew you both to medical missionary work?
We really felt a call to that kind of work from college. It was during college that I started feeling this call to use my life in missions, in loving and serving people in great need. And that's why I went to medical school, was to find some skill set that I could use to serve people in need. And Amber shared that same calling long before we got married. We both had that calling. And so we got married during my medical school, and we shared that calling together. And we wanted to use our skills as medical professionals to serve people in great need.
So medical missionary work, just to sort of understand the philosophy, is your goal to share your faith with patients, or is it to serve God by caring for people who are in need?
Yes. I think we set up a false dichotomy between those two things. And we think that sharing your faith means that you have to preach to every person you encounter. And we think that serving God through your actions means you don't say anything, you just do. And I don't think we should compartmentalize our lives that way. I certainly did not preach to every patient that I encountered in Liberia, but I also didn't try to hide my motivations for serving and loving people in a really hard place. And I think I think there's a tension there, but it's a healthy tension to keep our actions and our minds and our motivations and our words cohesive.
A life of travel seems, first of all, you two do nothing halfway, we should say, but it seems like this is just right for the two of you. Amber, will you tell us how you met?
We met while I was in college as a pre-nursing student, and I was an intern with some missionaries in Honduras. And Kent came with a group from his church for just a couple of weeks that summer, and we met while in the mountains of Honduras doing very basic triage sort of medicine in a very rural place there. I was working with a nurse practitioner who's a missionary in Honduras. And I taught Dr. Kent Brantley, how to measure blood pressure. And we became friends, and the rest is history. It took him a few years to notice me, but it was worth the wait.
How did resources in Liberia, and we're skipping all over the timeline here, but how did the resources in Liberia compare with what you had at a place like John Peter Smith Hospital in Fort Worth where you did your training?
There really is no comparison. There really isn't. I watched a video that a journalist made about caring for patients with Ebola. And in the video, she was mentioning that it's supportive care, which means monitoring and giving IV fluids. And they flashed a picture of this high-tech monitor that had the pulse wave and the heart rate and the respiratory rate on the monitor.
Standard issue in a U.S. hospital.
Right. Like you see in every hospital room in America. That doesn't exist in Liberia. And we were making decisions every day about who do we give oxygen to, because we only have 3 bottles of oxygen in the hospital and we have 8 patients who probably need it. And maybe all 3 of those bottles have oxygen, or maybe we only have 2 nasal cannulas left. And so it's hard to compare. It's hard to explain how limited the resources are in a place like Liberia, because there's no comparison.
So what happens to your medical training, all these protocols that you've been taught to follow? I gather suddenly you have to get much more creative.
You have to get creative. You have to it's frustrating in a lot of ways, especially for young folks like me right out of their training who say, okay, I learned how to do all of this. Now I'm going to go do it. And I tell the story in the book of my very first patient. It was a young boy with diabetes. And I knew how to treat the problem that he had. I had treated it time and time again at JPS. But I didn't have the lab to guide my therapy. I didn't have the pumps to correctly adjust the medications I needed to give him. And I didn't have the monitors to monitor his condition that I had always used to guide the therapy of that disease. And so you have to improve your clinical acumen. You have to rely on your physical exam and history a lot more than we tend to here. And you have to be creative. You have to figure out, what do we have that can meet the need for this patient, because I don't have the thing that I would usually use.
When you and your colleagues realized that Ebola could, in fact, come to the hospital that you were working at, that it could be part of, you know, your daily workflow, what kinds of preparations did you make about how to be ready for these patients?
I am really thankful for the colleagues that I worked with there, Dr. Debbie Eisenhut, Dr. John Fankhauser, and others who had a lot more foresight than I did. And as soon as when we had our first doctor's meeting following the headlines about Ebola coming to Liberia, they said, we've got to get ready immediately. And they convinced me right away that we had to get ready immediately. We downloaded a manual on the internet. It was 180 pages or so, called Treatment of Viral Hemorrhagic Fevers in the African Healthcare Setting, which seemed really appropriate. And Dr. Debbie Eisenhut, who's a general surgeon from Oregon, took that manual, digested it, and created like a 3-hour hands-on curriculum that every person in our hospital went through, the cashiers, the janitors, the nurses, the doctors. And we used whatever we had at our disposal at that time. We didn't have the Tyvek suits and all the personal protective equipment like we used later on. In those first days, we were using cotton surgical gowns and tying bandanas around our heads. And we didn't ever have to use those kinds of things when we actually started seeing patients. But in our first days of preparation, when we were practicing putting on personal protective equipment, it was that kind of stuff.
Amber, you are a medical professional. Your husband is a medical professional. You know that you can trust him to take precautions. I wonder, though, emotionally, how it felt for you when he came home the first night that he had been treating a patient with Ebola, and you have 2 preschoolers at home who are not known to follow any medical protocols or, you know, be careful about anything. Does the mom in you leap ahead of the nurse in you, or are they sort of wrestling for control?
I really trusted in the science. I trusted in the procedures and the protocols that had been tested and put in place by Doctors Without Borders and WHO. And I trusted Kent. And I knew that his own thinking, that if he felt safe coming home to us, then I felt that that was a safe thing to do. So I trusted him completely. And I trusted in the steps and the system. And I wasn't overly, you know, in the beginning I was a little nervous, but once he made the choice to come home, then I felt that it was good for our family, it was good for us, and it was good for us to be there with him. So.
She did make me shower before the kids could
hug
me, though.
Yeah, yeah. Strip in the doorway and go to the shower.
Was it emotionally stressful? I mean, I don't know how it wouldn't be to have these patients coming in who were desperately ill and knowing that you could maybe make them a little more comfortable, but that you were really powerless against the infection.
Yeah, it was really stressful. It was emotionally stressful. It was also, it was just hard. It was hard to want to save a life and be totally powerless to do it. And our very first patient, she actually started improving after a couple of days, and we thought, we did it. Our first patient is going to survive. And then the next day she just took a nosedive, and within 36 hours she passed away. It was really defeating to see that happen over and over and over. But we also knew that there was no alternative. We couldn't just say, well, we're done with this. It's not working. We're going to quit treating patients with Ebola. We had no choice but to continue treating them and to try to do it in the kindest, gentlest, most compassionate way that we could.
You write about this later from your own experiences. On top of everything else, on top of the dire nature of the illness itself, this is no small thing that it's humiliating to have Ebola and to be unable to care for yourself.
Part of the problem that led to the spread of the epidemic initially was, I think it had to do with that humiliation. Not only was it humiliating to the individual as they lost control of their bodily functions and had to have somebody do everything for them, wipe their bottom, literally. But it was also embarrassing to the family members. You know, there was a stigma attached to Ebola, and whether it's because of the mortality of it or the idea that it was from a curse, people did not want to admit that they or one of their family members had Ebola. So a family member would get sick and have all the classic symptoms of Ebola, and they would keep them at home, and the person would die at home, and they would try to hide the body and bury it themselves because they didn't want anybody to know that there was Ebola in their home.
So at this really stressful time, it's funny the way life works out. There was a joyous occasion in your family, Amber, before Kent got sick, and you left with the children to fly home, and he was going to join you. Was that leave-taking all that difficult? Did you think, okay, I'll see you in a week? And
it was very much just, I'll see you next week. And I was glad for a break because Kent mentioned that it was stressful. It was extremely stressful for the whole family and for the whole team that was there, really. So I was welcoming the vacation and looking forward to him joining us. And I had hoped that he could, you know, rearrange his schedule to come early with us. And he just couldn't get away for that. But it was, he took us to the airport. It was very much, I'll see you next week. And he was going right to work from there and moving patients to a bigger unit that day. And it was a big, big day of work for him. And he got up early to take us to the airport. And it was just a very, very much, I'll see you next week. And I can't wait.
We're speaking this hour with Nurse Amber Brantley and Dr. Kent Brantley, a husband and wife team who served as medical missionaries for Samaritan's Purse. Their new book is called Called for Life, How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us into the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic. They'll be signing copies of the book tonight at 6:30 at Southside Church of Christ in Fort Worth. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the husband and wife co-authors of a new memoir called For Life, How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us Into the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic. We're speaking this hour with Nurse Amber Brantley and Dr. Kent Brantley. He was the first American to be diagnosed with Ebola and survived the disease. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. All right, Kent, you didn't feel well just almost exactly a year ago, a year and a week or 10 days ago, and assumed it was minor, but were aware enough of what was going on, I guess, that you had the instinct to stay home from work.
Right. I really thought it would blow over by lunch. I thought it was the pizza with Tabasco sauce I'd had the night before, and I thought it would blow over by lunch. I had a lot of administrative work to do, and I knew that I had been working in the world's worst Ebola outbreak for 6 or 7 weeks, and so staying home was the better part of valor.
Initially, you thought, as your fever continued to climb, you thought maybe it's malaria. That's sort of the next most obvious thing to think about.
Yeah, I was hoping it was malaria. When I developed a fever,
yeah,
that kind of changed the game. But I had a box of rapid malaria tests on the shelf in my house. You keep those things around when you live in a place like Liberia. And I took two of them that day around lunchtime when my fever began climbing. And they were both negative. But I'd had the box on the shelf a while, and I thought, maybe it's a bad lot. Maybe I just need a one from another box.
Was any part of you in denial?
It's hard to know what is denial and what is
optimism.
Optimism, yeah, hope. I didn't think that I had Ebola. So maybe mentally I was denying it, but I wasn't in denial so far as to go about life like normal and put other people at risk. I stayed home. I was holding on to hope that it was something else, but I isolated myself, and no one came into my house without putting on personal protective equipment. So maybe it was denial, but it was at least it was a functional denial. I don't know.
Conscious.
You called your colleagues. I would imagine the hardest call to make was to Amber.
Yeah. I don't really remember making that phone call.
I know you remember it, Amber.
I remember. He called me just about as soon as he found out himself. He picked up the phone to call me, and he was so calm and matter of fact, and he knew I had been waiting for his call, so he just got right down to the point and said the test result came back and it was positive. And I wanted to be so strong and encouraging to him in that moment and say something that would inspire or uplift, and all I could say was, I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry. I was sorry for him that he'd have to go through it and suffer in that way, and I was sorry for myself.
The thought of being so far away, and it was just an accident that that happened, and it was lucky because you and your kids, he wouldn't have to worry about you, but I can't imagine what it would be like to be so far away.
I hated it. I wanted so badly to be beside him and bring him chicken broth and clean water to drink and be there to help him when he was lonely. But he kept telling me how thankful he was that I wasn't there, that I wasn't with him in bed when he woke up feeling sick. And I don't know what we would have done if that had been the case, or what we would have done with the kids, or, you know, you can what if and speculate all the time, but I'm just really thankful that I wasn't there.
I remember following the news reports pretty carefully when the story broke here. And of course, everybody felt a connection because you had a Texas connection. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very human story that I think a lot of people can relate to. And a lot of the stories focused on the fact that, well, he's walking around, he's using his computer. And I think a lot of people back home might have been deluded into thinking you had sort of and forgive me if this sounds ignorant, a milder case of Ebola. That was not the case at all. And we'll get a little bit into what happened as your symptoms got worse and worse. But I caught myself thinking about, do you remember that story about the guy who climbed Everest and he got stuck on Everest and it became apparent that he wouldn't get down and he was going to die there, but he had a satellite phone and he could talk to his wife. And I thought about you too, because I thought, at what point do you hang up the phone if this might be the last call you ever have?
It's strange because I never really had that thought. I mean, I thought I may never see my wife and kids again, but I don't remember thinking every time we talked, this could be it. This could be the last time I see her. But Amber had those thoughts.
I did. Every time we were able to FaceTime as well as talk on the phone. And I was very aware that this might be the last time that we see him. And so I took a screenshot every time, because I wanted to have that picture. I wanted the kids to have that. And what do you say? I just said I love you over and over, because that might be the last thing I ever say to you.
Did you let the kids talk to him?
They did some, but they were at their grandparents, and there were aunts and uncles and dogs around, and they were pretty busy playing, and they talked to him some, but were distracted and happy and pretty ignorant and wonderfully, blissfully ignorant. So
you had a lot of people praying for you, for your whole family. And I know that you both feel really strongly that this played a role in your survival. I wonder what you do with the reality that lots of other people had lots of people who loved them and prayed for them and didn't live.
That is a reality that makes me wrestle with a lot of the hard questions we've wrestled with since all this happened. Because I am so thankful to all the people who prayed for me. When we got to go back to Liberia last month, to hear my Liberian friends tell me how they and their churches were praying for us, fasting for us, how they were brokenhearted for Amber and praying for her, that was so meaningful. But I don't think that I'm alive today because prayer works by whoever has the most people praying for them wins.
It's not a poll, right?
No, it makes me wrestle with how does God work? I still believe with all my heart that he is ultimately behind my survival, just like he is behind the survival of everyone else who made it. You look at videos of Liberian Ebola survivors coming out of the unit being discharged. So many of them are saying, thank God. I thank God I'm alive today. There's a difference between saying, I thank God I'm alive today, and I know that God saved my life because people prayed for me. And I'm right now more in that camp of saying, I thank God that I'm alive today. And I give him the credit for it. But that doesn't, there's a real tension there that 11,294 other people have died. 11,294, and the outbreak's not over. There's still people dying every week.
Yeah, we heard two new cases reported yesterday.
Two new cases in a part of Sierra Leone where there had been no cases for like 4 months.
Yeah.
Last week, there were 7 cases diagnosed in Sierra Leone and Guinea. The week before that, there were 30. And we don't talk about that. You know, it's not in the headlines as much. But the outbreak's not over. So I will always wrestle with the why and the how. Why did I get sick? Why do I get to live when so many other people have died, when some of my friends, some of my coworkers died? And how did that work? How is it that I'm alive and they're not? I'll always wrestle with those questions, but I may never come up with a satisfactory answer. The question I will answer is, so what now? What am I going to do with my life? And right now, what I can do is try to help the people in West Africa who are still suffering from this disease.
And other diseases.
Absolutely. There have been a lot more people killed by malaria and typhoid and childbirth in the last year and a half than Ebola.
I wonder how you made sense of the uproar in the United States, there are still billboards in uptown Dallas saying, if you have Ebola symptoms, make a call. And we can certainly understand people's concern about those who actually became ill. It also seems there was a great deal of fear. And compared to the relative risks of being in West Africa, the fear we had in this country seems to have been larger than the need for that fear. And I wonder, watching that coverage, Amber, what you think, and if it frustrates you, if it saddens you, if it, I don't know how you feel about it.
We were so sad to hear about Thomas Eric Duncan and his diagnosis with Ebola. We were heartbroken. We wept over him. And then to hear that some of his nurses had contracted it, it was shocking and stunning and just so, so sad. I wish that people could be moved toward sorrow for that case instead of toward fear, and that that if you had not been contacted by authorities, that you're on a list, that they're watching your temperature, then you have no cause for fear. And what we saw out of the outbreak in Dallas, and the doctor in New York who was diagnosed in New York, who had been volunteering in West Africa, that system worked. He sought treatment. And it was advertised that, you know, he'd been on the subway and he'd gone bowling and where he'd eaten. And there was so much panic and fear related to that. But if you look back now, it worked. The systems worked and people were kept safe. And you look at the people who were actually in the apartment with Mr. Duncan when he was sick, and they did not get sick. And so it is a bit irrational to think that living in that same complex or city or state puts you at higher risk. It wasn't. It didn't pan out that way, and I'm thankful for that. And I think you can see that our health system was able to overcome that outbreak. And you look at the health systems in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea who've not been able to contain it. It's such an imbalance. And I think we would do better to have compassion on those who are suffering from this disease in West Africa than to fear that it might come to us.
Reading the book, Kent, when you were still up and around and you hadn't been sick yet, it's very evident that you made a point of trying to connect with your patients on a human level, to recognize that they were afraid, that they felt awful. Is it just something in you? Is it part of your training that you're able to do this? I mean, fully gloved and protected, but that you're able to sort of see through the disease and look at the person when you're taking care of them?
I don't think that's anything special about me. I think that's why people become physicians, because they want to fill that gap. They want to take care of people who have illnesses. We don't treat illnesses. We treat people who have illnesses.
But you know that some people struggle with that more than some physicians, some nurses
sure.
are extraordinary, probably most of them. But it's not easy for everyone.
And it's not easy when 80% of your patients are dying either.
Yeah.
But in some ways that those circumstances we were in Liberia, in the midst of the Ebola outbreak, it was intense, but it was the kind of intense that magnifies your purpose for what you're doing rather than making it harder to have compassion on the people. It made it easier because it reminded you that that's why you're there.
Hmm. As you started to feel sicker, I wonder, you both in the book describe the amount of, for whatever reason, calm that you were able to have. But you'd also see this play out in very close range. You knew what you were in for. Were you afraid of the suffering that was to come, even if you were to survive?
I was afraid. I had a lot of fear and probably more anxiety even than fear. But when I vomited blood, you know, I had seen patients with Ebola do that. I'd also seen patients at JPS with liver problems or whatever have those symptoms. To see that kind of problem in your own body is anxiety invoking. I don't know how much I was worried about what was to come as much as I was just anxious about what I was seeing at any given moment.
How much did you want to know, Amber, about the details of where he was in his illness?
I wanted to know more than what he was telling me. But I think he was being very gentle with me in that. I knew enough. He was telling me plenty to know that his symptoms were progressing and getting worse. And that was enough.
We learned when we were talking with John Fankhauser, who was kind of my primary caregiver for the first week of my illness. He told Amber something that I didn't remember, and that was that I told him not to call her. That he had wanted to call her and kind of give her an update, and I had told him, don't do that. I'll talk to her myself.
And is he the guy, Amber, that you said, I need to know every single morning what's going on?
That was Dr. Plyler, who was the team leader and was overseeing the disaster response team from Samaritan's Purse. And so he was also overseeing Kent's care and Nancy's care as she was sick too. And
this is Nancy Reitbel, the other person who that outbreak.
Mm-hmm. I really kind of let him have it one day when I hadn't heard. And I sat on pins and needles every day until I got my first call from Liberia, whether it was from him or Kent or Dr. Fankhauser. I just waited to hear that he'd made it through the night and what he was looking like now. And then to learn so many months later that it was Kent who had said not to call me, it was aggravating. But.
We're speaking this hour with Nurse Amber Brantley and Dr. Kent Brantley. They're a husband and wife. They served as medical missionaries for Samaritan's Purse. Kent Brantley was the first American medical worker serving Ebola patients to contract the virus himself. Their memoir is Called for Life, How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us into the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic. They will be signing copies of the book tonight at 6:30 at Southside Church of Christ in Fort Worth. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Nurse Amber Brantley and Dr. Kent Brantley, husband and wife. Their new memoir is Called for Life, How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us into the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic. It's about how they went to Liberia to serve people who had medical needs, and Dr. Kent Brantley was diagnosed with the disease himself, later flown to the United States, and survived. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, I want to talk about ZMapp, which is this experimental drug that people have heard about. Lots of people have questions about it, and I know you don't produce ZMapp and you don't work for the organization that does. But there were a limited number of doses. Initially, the understanding was that whoever would benefit from it had to have all of the doses that were there in Liberia.
Right. There was one course of treatment available. It was three doses to be given 3 days apart each. It's an IV infusion. It's given in a bag of IV fluid over about a four-hour period. It had never been given to a human being before. So nobody knew. You couldn't look up in a book and say, what's the dosing regimen for ZMapp?
Mm-hmm. What are the side effects?
Nothing. Right. They were basing the recommendations for the doses on what they had given the monkeys in the animal trials. And they said, we don't know if this is going to work or not, but it all needs to be given to the same person if it's going to work. And at the time that it was made available to us, I was feeling a little better. And I thought maybe I had turned the corner. And I had a discussion with the doctors taking care of me. And I said, I think we need to give it to Nancy. She's older than I am. She's sicker than I am. And we were also talking about evacuation. I thought, maybe I've turned the corner. I'm going to be evacuated in the next couple of days. Let's give it to Nancy. And that was the plan. The stuff was frozen solid, and it was going to take quite a while to thaw it out. So they had taken a vial of it and put it under Nancy's arm to allow it to warm up slowly. And it was during that next 24 or 36 hours that my condition deteriorated dramatically. And it was also during that time that the evacuation became a reality, that the plane was going to come and one of us was going to go. And they decided that there was nothing to be lost by splitting those doses between the two of us. They said, Kent, we can give you one dose, and that will leave two for Nancy. And you will be in Atlanta in time for your second and third dose if the medication's available, if you need it. And Nancy will be in Atlanta with you too, Lord willing, in time for her third dose. So there's no harm in trying to give you the first dose.
Initially, and it does seem to have made a remarkable difference in your condition, but it was awful when you took it, right? It looked like it might be killing you rather than saving you.
I had some kind of reaction to it, and I think that is common. I've talked to some people who are familiar with monoclonal antibodies because they're often used in treatment of different kinds of cancers. And they said that kind of reaction that I experienced is not uncommon with initial doses of monoclonal antibodies. The rigors, the whole body shaking, and it just happened that those symptoms of that reaction were also worsening the problem that the Ebola was causing for me, which was difficulty in breathing. And it did, for the first 20 or 30 minutes, I felt like I was getting worse. But after that initial phase, the shaking stopped and my condition stabilized. I improved a little bit and I was able to get up and walk to the bathroom for the first time in quite a while.
What kind of hope did you attach to that ZMAP dose?
Again, we didn't know a whole lot about it. I didn't even know what it was called or if it had been named. I just knew that Dr. Plyler and Dr. Finkhauser had read some of the study, and that the way it had been explained to Kent that it showed positive results in monkeys, but it had never been given to a human being of any kind before. And so it was, I don't know how much hope I had in that. It was just like, okay, we'll try anything. I hope it works. I don't know how great a hope I had for that.
I know you've both heard the criticism people have said, if there's this miracle drug, why is it given to two white Americans and not given to, Liberians who are very ill? Can you talk about the nature of consent when it's an experimental drug and how that works and how this was made available to you and Nancy Reitbol over other patients?
First of all, I can't answer why it was made available to us and not anybody else, except that there was only enough of it for one person. Mm-hmm. But I can't answer why was it given to us. I don't know. I will never know. But the idea of giving experimental drugs to people who are critically ill with a disease that has a high mortality rate is not a straightforward process. It has a lot of complicating factors. To gain informed consent from a person who thinks they're going to die anyway, first of all, that biases the whole conversation. Even in my case, I'm sure that conversation was biased because I felt like I don't have any other chance of living. But also, especially in the context of an Ebola outbreak in a place like West Africa, where most of the caregivers are Westerners, say we're dealing with American caregivers, trying to explain cross-culturally and across language barriers to a person who does not have medical literacy, all of the unknown risks of taking a drug that's never been given to a person before, I at least was in a position to say, okay, I understand how drugs come about and what the clinical trial system is, and I understand that this drug's never been used before, and I may have an anaphylactic reaction and die from receiving it, and I'm willing to accept those risks. That's a hard conversation to have with somebody across cultural and language barriers and across the barriers of I don't know what else to call it, says medical literacy, being able to understand medical jargon and a Western medical system.
Well, and even Nancy Reitbol was trusting you. She didn't have the medical literacy and didn't even have the language barriers that you mentioned. And she said, well, what are you going to do, Kent? I'll do whatever you say you'll do. That I'll be fine with that.
Yeah.
When you came back, you were in Emory Hospital, and lots of people watched the video when you were taken off the plane, and I think you walked under your own power. Is that right?
With some assistance from the paramedic.
A lot of people were very relieved to see you back in a modern hospital. You were not out of the woods. You weren't sort of there just relaxing for a few weeks. It was still touch and go. Can you both describe to me the moment that you were able to actually touch each other skin to skin for the first time?
It was August 20th, 2014 in the afternoon. They came to my room, and one of the doctors came to my room and told me that they had gotten my test results back from the previous two tests. They would draw my blood every day or every other day and send it to the CDC for testing. And sometimes we wouldn't get a result back right away. And so if it was over the weekend, it might be a couple of tests that we get back results for at the same time. And that was the way that it worked. They came and said, you've had two negative tests over a two-day period. And so I called Amber, who was in the cafeteria at the hospital eating lunch, and I said, you need to come back up here. So she came back up. We received that news together, and then I went through the decontamination process, basically just showering, cleaning off, and putting on clothes that had not been inside my isolation room, that kind of thing, and was able to walk out into the hallway and give her a hug for the first time.
One of the nurses, Jill, had taken your wedding ring to decontaminate it and handed it to me in the hall so that I could give that to Kent when he came out. And it was sweet and romantic and cheesy and and great. And so there were always nurses standing by, too. So one of them was there to take some pictures of us when he finally walked out of his room, and we hugged for the first time in a long time.
How did you, it was still even weeks after you were released from the hospital that you were, would get tired out pretty quickly. And I wonder what it felt like. Do you remember the first morning where you woke up and thought, I'm me again?
It wasn't really a morning when I woke up. It was around Christmas time when I was at my parents' house with my whole large family. I had three teenage nieces who were exercising together, doing like a boot camp video on the internet. And I joined in with them for two or three days in a row. And it was in the middle of one of those workouts where I said, I think I'm back to normal now. I can almost keep up with my 16-year-old niece.
How much have you talked to your children who are still very young about this? And is there, is there a point that you imagine that you'll sort of fill them in on every detail?
I think we'll be talking about it for years to come. You know, it'll be part of our family history. We filled them in somewhat when we were back together, when Kent was released from the hospital and we went to get them back, and it was just the four of us at dinner, and we talked to the kids about Kent's sickness and that he had Ebola and he was getting better. And I think now they've heard us speak a lot or seen us on programs or talking to friends that they've heard a whole lot of those details. And I don't know how much their 6 and 4 year old minds are comprehending, but I think they're getting it. I think that they understand when Kent travels to speak somewhere, they say, well, I know, I'm sorry you have to go. I don't like you leaving, but I know you have to go tell people how God saved your life. They say it like this, like, ha. Oh.
Do you ever have that moment where you're like in Target picking out a head of lettuce and they're like, Daddy, because you had Ebola, do you, I mean, are there those moments or?
Back in, I think it was December, we were walking through the airport. We went to one of the little magazine stores and there was a GQ magazine with Michael Sam on the cover. And my daughter said, why is he on the cover instead of you? Because he's famous.
Will August 20th be a different kind of anniversary for you, do you think?
We've had a lot of those kind of anniversaries in the last couple of weeks as we've marked the day that Amber and the kids left me in Liberia. And as
July
we've marked
20th.
The day that I woke up sick and the day of my diagnosis and the day of my blood transfusions and the day that I thought I was going to die and the day of my evacuation and my arrival in Atlanta. And August 20th and August 21st when I was released from the, when I was, Dr. Ribner prefers the term discharged from the hospital. He says, we weren't holding you captive. But when I got out of the hospital, those will always be special and memorable dates for our family. I think that's something we will recount for years to come. On July 26th this year, I called all of my siblings and my parents and said, hey, just calling to tell you I'm doing well and I don't have Ebola anymore.
We just have a few seconds left. I wonder if you could speak briefly to what you think is the right balance between private NGO aid and religious organizations and USAID investing in healthcare in the developing world.
I
know 30 seconds is not enough.
No, I think the more pertinent point right now is that this outbreak in West Africa is not over. And we, ordinary, normal people, need to be involved in coming up with a solution. And part of that involves supporting organizations that are on the ground trying to bring an end to this outbreak, whether they are religious not-for-profits or secular NGOs or governmental agencies. We all need to be working together to come up with a solution to put an end to this public health crisis that's been going on for a year and a half.
Dr. Kent Brantley and Nurse Amber Brantley are husband and wife, co-authors of the new memoir Called for Life, How Loving Our Neighbor Led Us into the Heart of the Ebola Epidemic. They will be signing copies of the book tonight at 6:30 at Southside Church of Christ in Fort Worth. Thanks so much to both of you for
being
here.
Thanks for having us.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.